I get to dedicate this week's sikha.
I don't think
the Rosh Yeshiva also does. I'll dedicate this sikha to Natan Weiss.
Oh, how?
And
you get a shot?
I do, but I don't want to share it. It's between me and him. And to Alex Wiener.
You have a pshat?
It's the same nekuda, but from two very different angles.
Rosen.
I'm going to dedicate this hat also to Josh Razi. Okay. And to Zachary Nugget.
Right here.
There you go. So Zachary Nugget asked me this afternoon what's the sikha about, and I gave him an answer, and that's not what it's about, because after this afternoon I wasn't sure what it was going to be about, and I don't know, just what I told him didn't happen. It'll happen next week, maybe, but it'll happen next week. But I'm going to talk about a little bit about what I think is a very controversial Dvar Torah. I shared it with my shiur this morning. It's a controversial Dvar Torah. I actually saw it in a sefer called, after I heard it years ago, I saw it in a sefer called Unlocking the Torah Text. But despite the fact it's a little controversial Dvar Torah, I think the idea, as an idea, is a very, very good idea. How it's applied is a bit controversial, which I'll share with you the controversy. And then I want to use that as a jumping point to discuss what I want to discuss. And that is the following. The Dvar Torah is as follows. The parasha opens up both in a similar way with Yaakov. It opens up with Yaakov having a dream, and it also closes the end of the parasha. Also, Yaakov depicts a dream that he has. And if you study these two dreams, you look at the two dreams. The first dream is Yaakov dreaming about angels going up and going down a ladder. The ladder is based in earth, and the ladder's top reaches Shamayim, and it's about the angels that are going up and down a ladder, somehow bridging heaven and earth. And that's his dream as he's about to leave Eretz Yisrael. As the Torah tells us, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva Vayelech Harana. He's leaving Eretz Yisrael to go to Haran. And Vayitka B'makom Vayalan Sham, he lies down, he rests, and in his dream, as he's leaving Eretz Yisrael, he dreams about angels going up and down this ladder. As a very, very important aside, is Rashi says on the first pasuk, is bothered, why do you have two verbs in that pasuk? Why does the Torah tell us, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva, Vayelech Harana? Why do I have to know that he's leaving Be'er Sheva? I know he lives in Be'er Sheva, he was in Be'er Sheva. If he's going to Haran, of course he's leaving Be'er Sheva. And Rashi cites a famous Chazal, and Rashi explains that the idea that we're told that he's leaving Be'er Sheva is when a tzaddik leaves a place, it makes a roshan. It makes a mark on the place. A person's supposed to impact the place that he's in. And if a person is just a regular person, just a regular Joe, could be that he's not having a major impact on the place that he's in, but he's a tzaddik. That means he's instrumental to that place, he has influence on that place, and when he leaves that place, the place is very, very different than when it was before he left the place. So Rashi says it emphasized by Yetze, mi Be'er Sheva, to tell us that Be'er Sheva was a different place as a result of Yaakov leaving. Well, if a tzaddik can have influence on a place, so the reverse is probably true as well. And we know it to be true as well, is that a place or an environment can also have influence on a person. And when a person's in one kind of environment, the environment impacts and influences his ideas, his ideologies, his values. And depending on where you are, the place that you're in will impact your ideologies, your values, your visions. A person in yeshiva will be influenced in one direction. A person in university will have a different kind of influence, and that certainly is, if you will, the flip side of what Rashi expresses. Well, Yaakov, when he is in leaving Eretz Yisrael, when he lies down, he dreams about angels. If you look at the end of the parsha, when he tells his wives why it's time to leave Lavan, he's been there for 20 years in Haran. Special welcome to Srili Stein. He's been in Lavan's house for 20 years in Chutz La'aretz, and he tells his wives it's time to leave, and he describes them a dream that he has, and he dreams about sheep, spotted and speckled sheep, a very cryptic little dream, and he says in the dream there was a malach that came to him and told him it is time to leave the house of Lavan to go back home to Eretz Yisrael. And this Sefer writes that what's the perhaps a message here in these two dreams? So the message is that even Yaakov Avinu, on his level, at some point, 20 years in the house of Lavan, even though we'll learn next week, Taryag Mitzvah Shamarti, he kept the Taryag Mitzvahs, and Lo Amarti Ma'asav Haraim, but even a Yaakov Avinu, 20 years in Beis Lavan in Chutz La'aretz, the place can have an impact. And all of a sudden, the dreams that he has at night are no longer dreams of angels bridging heaven and earth. He doesn't dream about malachim, but he's dreaming about sheep. And as a result of 20 years in that environment, we're not saying, the reason I say it's controversial is because Yaakov is Yaakov Avinu. But perhaps even Yaakov Avinu, at some point, what we dream about at night is what we think about by day. And if he's involved all day with sheep, with making a living, with parnasa, so that consumes him and that pulls him in, that's what he's dreaming about at night. And a person's dreams, what he's thinking about, his visions and his goals reflect what he's involved in during the daytime. And a person has to understand his visions, his dreams, represent what he's about. If he's consumed during the daytime with spirituality, then he dreams about malachim. If he's consumed about materialism, gashmius, parnasa, working with sheep, so then that becomes potentially his dreams as well. And it's a big challenge, this concept. Because most of us, if I were to take a survey of where we're headed in the long term, how many people are going to be involved in an abundance, a large amount of their day involved in making a living, parnasa, work? So most of us, if I were to take a survey, how many people here see themselves in chinuch or in the rabbanus? Raise your hand. Okay, how many of us see ourselves in non-rabbinic, chinuch, Jewish education type fields? How many of us have not raised our hands? Why? Unsure? Uncertain? Okay, fair enough. But the majority is going to be in what I call the working world. And the working world is a world that is very, very mundane. It's very challenging, and one that requires us, demands on us, to focus on really what we don't have. And if you think about even the world of advertising, and I just pulled this volume, which is a fascinating book called To Kindle a Soul. And he writes here, the commercialism that we are exposed to. Last week, Black Friday. What is the message of Black Friday?
Shop.
Shop. And before Black Friday, the month before Black Friday, this whole month, going into the secular holidays, what's the message?
Get ready.
Is get ready. There's a lot of good stuff out there. Stuff that you really, really might not have, and you really, really want. It's focusing on what you want. Perhaps even what you need. Because after all, who could live life without a 20, 35-inch plasma TV and the latest iPad, pod, whatever, and this vehicle and this device and so forth? And the focus of the industry, the advertising industry, especially in television, is on what we do not have. And what we no doubt want. It is preying on our lacking. We're lacking, and we feel, when we're exposed to this in a very serious way, you feel a little bit empty. I'm just going to read to you that the television industry, just so you understand what the television industry is about, is not in the business. This is, I'm quoting, the Journal of American Medical Association. The television industry is not in the business of selling programs to audiences, in the business of selling audiences to advertisers. Issues of quality and social responsibility are entirely peripheral to the issue of maximizing audience size within a competitive market. Television does not exist to entertain us, it exists to sell to us. And when they're selling to us these things that they know or that they want to impress upon us, we want, we're lacking, and we ought to have. And that kind of mindset, if it's focused on what you're missing, what you need to buy, what you need to have, truthfully, could really be the product or the produce a certain sense of unhappiness. And I was in Cleveland a couple of weeks ago, and I picked up a fantastic set of letters that were written by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks from England, and a letter that he writes, fictional letters that he's writing to his older children. And he talks about the challenge of a consumer society. And he writes as follows: the whole of consumer society is based on stimulating demand to generate expenditure to produce economic growth. This involves turning genuine values upside down. Advertising creates a thousand blandishments that focus our minds on what we don't have, while real happiness, as Pirkei Avos tells us, lies in rejoicing in what we do have. Ezehu Ashir Hasameach Bechelka. And a person can be very, very wealthy in his bank account, but if he feels wanting and lacking and desirous of more and more things, at the end of the day, he's not so wealthy. So in a curious way, a consumer society is a mechanism for creating and distributing, he writes, unhappiness. That is why an age of unprecedented affluence, this generation, unprecedented affluence, also became an age of unprecedented stress-related syndromes and depressive illnesses. The most important thing any of us can learn from the present economic crisis is think less about the price of things and more about the value of things. And to me, this is a very, very profound idea. We had a speaker this week who spoke about turning everything into Shabbos, turning Beis Medrash into Shabbos, because Shabbos is such a unique and special day. Because Shabbos is that day where you don't focus, since you can't involve yourself in buying and selling, in purchasing. Shabbos is that day where you're not focusing on the price of things, but you're supposed to focus on the value of things and what's really, really important. What are your dreams? What are you dreaming about? That tells you what's important. When you define for yourself what life is really all about, what's truly important in life, that's what you focus on during the day, and that's what your dreams are about at night. And a person has to be very, very sensitive when he orders his life, focuses his life, thinks about his purpose in life, figure out what your visions are, your dreams are, what you think is important, because that's ultimately what's going to bring you happiness. And if you feel you're focused on what you're missing, what you don't have, what you'd like to have, and you're focused on materialism, so ultimately, that is very much a recipe for a lot of stress, a lot of challenge, a lot of difficulty. If you focus on what you do have, Ezehu Asher Hasameach Bechelko, then all of a sudden, things are very, very different. The Brisker Rav was once talking to a person, and the Brisker Rav asked this person, Vos ist il? Which means, I said it wrong. Was sind ihr? And the question is, which means, what do you do? What are you? And the person said, I'm a businessman. And the Brisker Rav said again, was sind ihr? What are you? And he said, again, I'm a businessman. And he went again, asked him again, what are you? And the guy felt the brisket rub his heart. And he said, I'm a businessman. And the brisket rub said, I'm not hard of hearing. I heard you very well the first time, but you didn't answer my question. You answered the question of what you do for a living, what you do to make parnassa, but that wasn't what I asked. I asked, what are you? And if your answer is, I'm a businessman, that's what you are. So he says, not sure that's the right answer. Perhaps the right answer is what Yonah Hanavi was asked when he was on that boat, and it was topsy-turvy. The weather got rough, and the malachim, the sailors, asked Yonah, Ma melachtecha? What's your business? And he sure he could have answered, Navi Anochi, I'm a prophet. That's what I do for a living. And his answer was, Ivri Anochi, Ve'ez Hashem Elokecha Ani Yareh. What are you? I'm a Jew, and I fear heaven. I fear God. Our whole language, the English language, sets us up for this falsity. You ask the child, what do you want to be when you grow up? Well, being, what you want to be, being is your essence. And I'll tell you, doctor, lawyer, president, but it's a false question. What do you want to work in when you grow up? What's your livelihood going to be when you grow up? What do you want to be when you grow up? Strange answer to that question. And normally, what do you do? The typical answer is, what do you do? I am a lawyer. That's what I am. That's not the right formulation. Yeah, it's what I do. I earn money as a lawyer. But the formulation is already hinting to this distortion. The Gentile world, the secular world, which certainly has a great influence on us, because as we've mentioned, the world we're in impacts us, definitely has a real meaning. It doesn't understand what a Jew is really all about. It's very, very foreign. The secular world, again, one I worked in for a number of years, has a very, very foreign vision of what life is. I'll just share with a personal anecdote. In 1995, I told this to, I think, one of my shiurim, I forget which. In 1995, I made Aliyah. I told my law firm that I was moving from, I'm moving to Israel. We parted. They liked me. It was all good. And April of that year, I came here to Mevaseret to learn for a year. And April of that year, 1995, 1996, I sent an email to my law firm, my old law firm. I asked them if I can come back for the summer. I had no expectation that they would take me back. None whatsoever. It's very unorthodox and unusual. In fact, it doesn't happen that people are taken back for the summer. They take law students for summers, not 4, 5, 5-year lawyers. I sent them an email expecting a no, but why not? I'm not to lose. And to my shock and very pleasant satisfaction, they said yes. I went back for the summer. Had a good summer, made money, decent money. And with the money I made, I was able to stay Shana Bet and learn a second year here in Mevaseret. Had a good second year. And about January, February of that year, I sent an email to the law firm. Hey, it worked once, why not a second time? I sent an email to the law firm. How about I come back for the summer? And they said, sure, you can come back for the summer. I went back for the summer, worked a good 12, 14 weeks, and as a result of that, I was able to stay Shana Gimel. I spent the third year learning. And then, February, March or so of that third year, I sent an email to the law firm, said, can I come back for the summer? And usually they respond back within a couple of days. Here it took a couple of days past, no response. A little longer passed, no response. Finally, I'm getting a little nervous. I'm about to send another email. I get an email back, and sure enough, it was a response. And they said, yeah, you can come back for the summer. I was curious about the lack, but money's money. Parnassa is Parnassa. I went back and worked for the summer. Over the course of that summer, I had a friend who was a partner in that law firm, a firm guy, in my department. And at some point, he came to me and he said to me, I want you to know, in our meetings, in our partner meetings, deciding whether to take you back for the summer, this third summer, the decision was going to be no. But you got, he didn't say lucky, because he's a Torah Jew, He said, you had a lot of siyata d'shmaya. Because about 2 days after you sent the email, a senior person in the department told the firm he's leaving as of June. And since he was leaving as of June, they'd have a tough time replacing right away, so they figured they'd take him for the summer, give him some time to replace him. So there was siyata d'shmaya. But then he said the following. He said, they never really wanted you to come for the summer. That was never at all their objective. They didn't get at all why you'd want to go to Israel. Go to a third world country. I didn't tell them what I was doing here, but if I did, they really wouldn't get it. Learn ancient texts in a yeshiva. I was a 30-year-old man, like, make very, very little amount of money. No carpeting. Like, they're totally, they didn't get it. But you know why they took you back for those summers? We took you back for the summer because they figured that in a couple of years' time, you'll get this ridiculous notion out of your radar. You'll realize it's a foolish folly, and you'll certainly come back to the law firm full time. So they wanted to keep the kesher to come back full time, but they never, this summer, come back for the summer is a ridiculous thing. And the whole thing was to keep the kesher. When you're living as a Torah Jew in the secular world, there's a big disconnect. They don't get you. You get them. But they don't really, really get it. If you're living life in a certain way, they don't really, really get it. In fact, there's a story Rabbi Fran tells over. It's a very comical story. Of two lawyers. A New York lawyer from a firm called Baker & McKenzie, which is a big law firm based in Chicago. A very, very well-known giant law firm. And there's a lawyer in Baltimore, from Jew. They were doing a deal together. The lawyer from Baker came to Baltimore for some... And then the guy in Baltimore had to come to New York for some meetings. And the New York Baker McKenzie waspy lawyer said, listen, I know you're kosher for my trip to Baltimore, so I'll get you kosher food. Now, mind you, this is a week or two before Pesach. I'll get you kosher food. What kind of food? Do you need kosher food? I'll take care of it. No problem. He says, is Luigi Siegel's okay? Luigi Siegel's is a... you ever heard of Luigi Siegel's? It's this very Hamish kind of... It's the first restaurant in New York City. It's been around for about 100 years. But it's a decent restaurant. So he says, can I order in from Luigi Siegel's? He says, no problem. He calls Baker McKenzie lawyer, calls Luigi Siegel's. And he says, I have a kosher guy, I need some kosher food. He goes, what kind of food do you want? He goes, I want kosher food. He goes, yeah, no problem. We have, it's all kosher here. No problem. He goes, what do you want? He goes, I don't care what, just give me the most expensive thing on your menu. I'm sure he'll like it. He goes, fine. And they send him the most expensive thing. He comes to the law firm. They bring the lunch. And it's in this box. And he opens up the box. And inside the box is this big plate. And on that big plate, there is an egg and three pieces of matzah, and there is some maror and charoses, and like, that's what they sent. The most expensive thing on the menu, it's right before Pesach. And it's like, they had a takeout thing for, so like, they don't get it. They don't, it's a different world. And we understand that. And it's a very, very different world. That world defines itself in a lot of ways. And I've seen it front and center. Defines itself based on bank account. Defines itself based on money. And I'll tell you one other personal anecdote, which to me was always striking. When I was learning here, I go back to these summers. So I always used to go back early June. We had the yeshiva banquet. And I go back to the law firm early June. Now, early June, in my law firm, they used to have the first Monday, the second Monday of early June, they used to have what's called a firm outing. Now, the firm outing is a real, real treat. They take you to this place called the Sunningdale Country Club up in Westchester. And it is this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful... Nata, you've heard of it?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
But I like the Westchester Shadow.
Okay, it's this beautiful, beautiful golf course and tennis courts and pool, and they take the whole firm, all the lawyers, up to this place. And invariably, I'd fly out of Israel Sunday. I get there Monday, and my first day at work would be the Sunningdale Country Club. And it was pretty good. They got the kosher food. It was not Pesach time, so it was very good kosher food. And it was always my first day at work. And I remember I was very, very struck me. Again, the place you're in has an impact on you. It struck me tremendously. A couple of things struck me tremendously. One thing that struck me tremendously is when I was here learning, I was actually learning the Meretz Kola with the Israelis. Now, I don't know if you've seen one of the Israelis' apartments, but the Israeli apartments here in the Meretz Kola are tiny. I suspect that most of your living rooms are probably the size of their entire apartment. 50 meters, which is basically a tiny kitchen, a tiny living area, and two tiny bedrooms. Literally nothing. And they're living in these places with three, four, five children. And you know something? It's unbelievable. But they're tremendously happy. And you know why they're happy? Because they're doing what they want to be doing. They're learning. They're in yeshiva. They're very happy. And they're sameach b'chelka. And I was always struck how happy they were. Then I went, get on a plane, land in the Sunnyvale Country Club. Now every single car in the parking lot was a Lexus, a Cadillac, or anything, Jaguar, of that ilk, every single car. The average partner in the law firm is making between, minimum partner salary is about $800,000 a year, and went up to $2, $3 million. And then the average associate was also making very nice money. But I'm talking about the partners. They're making very, very good money. And I'm listening to one of my bosses, one of the partners in my department, and he's complaining to one of his colleagues. And it struck me. I can't make it. My mortgage is crazy. And my wife is high maintenance. And we go on a lot of vacations. And we have this and that and he's struggling. And he's making at least $1.2 million a year. And he's not paying yeshiva tuition. And he says he's unhappy because he doesn't have enough. And here are these guys in the Kollel who are living on literally a family of three or four living on maybe 2,000 shekel a month. And they somehow squeeze it by. And they're happy. And it's a fundamental yisod. What is it all about? What is life all about? And if it's about the pursuit of money, and it's about parnasa, and that's who we are, so this we're focusing very often on what we're missing and not what we have. Tremendous, tremendous idea from Rav Huttner. Rav Yitzchak Huttner was asked by a Talmud who was in the working world. And he asked him the following question. Rebbe, I feel like I have a double life. When I'm home, in shul, I'm learning, I feel like I'm a Torah Jew. When I go to the workplace, and I'm in my parnasa, so I feel like I'm in a different place, and I feel like I have a double life. So Huda told him, you don't necessarily have a double life. It's not a double life. And there's nothing wrong at all with being a doctor or lawyer or working and making money. And he gave him the following muscle. It's a tremendous idea. If a person has a house and then he rents an apartment in the other side of town, a secret apartment, and he does things in that secret apartment that maybe his family doesn't know about, his wife might not know about, but he has that place where he goes to do one part of his existence. That's his haven. So that's called a double life. But if a person has a house, and in his house, he has a den, and he has a living room, and he has a dining room, and he has a study, and he has different rooms under the same roof, that's not called a double life. That doesn't have to be a double life. That might be a broad life, an expansive life, but it's not a double life. And if your life in the working world, in parnasa, in business, is still under the same roof as your other life, as your Torah life, that's not called a double life. That's called a broad life. And Refrain tells the following stunning story about a Dr. Wallach in Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, a surgeon, a frum surgeon, and he's wheeling a patient being wheeled into serious surgery. And as the patient's being wheeled into the surgery room, Dr. Wallach goes to the patient and says, Reuven, tell me what your mother's name is so I can say Tehillim for her before I do the surgery. And you might say, that's crazy. A doctor saying Tehillim. He's supposed to go ahead and he must not have confidence in himself in the surgery. And the answer is absolutely not. The doctor who's doing the surgery understands that it's all under the same roof. And it's all part of the same rubric. It's all a big house with tehillim, with tefillah, and with medicine. And if it's all under the same roof, then it's all good, it's all fine, it's all perfect. Hutner adds the following idea: is the Gemara Bracha says, "Kol ha-ma'arich be'echad." If you, when you say Shema, you're ma'arich be'echad. You elongate the word echad. You say echad, and you elongate the word echad. Ma'arichin yamav. He'll be zocha to a long life. Hutner says, "Al pidrush, ma'arichin be'echad." You expand the echad. Who's the echad? Hashem, you make that your roof. You expand the breadth of that roof. And you'll be zochah to tremendous happiness, to tremendous accomplishment. That's not a double life. That's a broad life. And the goal is to be marich be'echad, to extend echad over the workplace. I know when I was working a lot, very long hours. Not uncommon, 10, 12, 14 hours a day. But it still was the case, at least for me, that the axis upon which my day revolved was my three minyanim, was my chavrusa in the morning before davening, was, if I got home in time, my night seder. So even though the breath and the dominant quantity of my day was in the workplace, but the axis upon which my day revolved was the tefillah, was the Torah, was my family, even though I didn't see them as much as I would have liked to. And that's the idea of being marich be'echa. When you go ahead and you want that broad life, be careful. Be careful what you're dreaming for and what you're dreaming about. And again, there's no steer between parnasa, working, and being an Eved Hashem. Not at all. But the idea is, what's the philosophy, what's the hashkafa, what are we dreaming about when we do so? I have a lot of friends who are my biggest role models. Friends who are my biggest role models. And these are people who are not in chinuch. People who are not teaching Torah, learning Torah all day. These are working people. But when they go ahead and work, and they've organized their days, they've organized in a fashion where it's all under one roof. It's not compartmentalized, it's not divided, it's a very, very broad life. I just want to give you one more idea, take 5 minutes, just one short idea that's related to the parasha as well. I was speaking to someone earlier this week. And we were talking, and he says, listen, you know, what can I do? My background is not a simple background. And I come from this school and this community. And it's what's my background? What do you expect? And that's a fair point. I just want to address that point for 5 minutes. And that is, backgrounds definitely influence where a person came from and where he's going to. But I want to share with you that life is very much a development. Life is very much a process. And a person should never just say in a reactive way, this is who I am, this is how I was built, this is my nature, this is my background. Part of taking control is being proactive, is understanding that you control and you have the ability to respond to stimuli as you choose to respond. And just this week's parasha has a very stunning concept, which I want to close with. We open up, we're told about the wives of Yaakov, Rachel, and Leah. And if I were to ask, if you read the beginning of the parasha, who's the beloved wife? Who's the one who's really the one who's tied to Yaakov? The answer is, of course, Rachel is described to us as beautiful. Yaakov loves her. The days of work, the years of work pass by in days. It's a real romantic kind of scene, and Rachel is the beloved. It's love at first sight. Leah, on the other hand, is the shunned woman, the shunned wife. And in fact, Chazal tell us, Einei Leah Rakos, she cries. Her eyes are soft, red, because of all the tears she shed. Why did she shed those tears? Because her lot is going to be Esav, not Yaakov. She's the other wife. And in fact, the Torah tells us that Rachel is the Ahuva, and Leah is the snua. She's the second wife. She's the hated one. Very harsh language that needs an interpretation, not for now. But this is how Leah is described to us. And then we're told about the children that are born. And the Torah describes to us, Leah has her first son and names him Reuven. And why does she call him Reuven? Because maybe now, does anyone remember the pasuk? Nope. Ra'a Hashem es anyi. Is that the pasuk? Mm-hmm. Maybe now Hashem will see my suffering. She describes herself as suffering. And then Shimon is born. And how does she name Shimon? Bataro kishama Hashem kisnu anochi. And then Levi is born. And maybe ata hapam, maybe now yilave ishi. Maybe now my husband will accompany me. And finally, Yehud is born, and she says, Hapam ode es Hashem. You see the process? She's suffering, she's hated. Maybe now my husband will accompany me, and then, finally, Hapam ode es Hashem, and then she ceases having children for now. Rachel, the beloved wife, starts to get frustrated, starts to get angry, starts to have tainas against her husband. I come out and have children, and you'll take a look at the pesukim. There's an outburst. In desperation, she says, take Bilhah. And finally, there are children with Bilhah, but she now becomes the wife who is yearning, who is childless, and who feels lacking. And if you look at these two women, it's amazingly striking. But Rachel starts with such a high, with such aspirations, with such potential. And at the end of the day, finally she zocha to have children. But in her having her second child, Binyamin, she dies in childbirth. And you look at Leah, and Leah is going to end up being the mother of six of the Shvatim, half of Klal Yisrael is coming from Leah. And when you think about it, where does Leah get buried? And where does Rachel get buried? Rachel gets buried in Beit Lechem on the outskirts of Eretz Yisrael, right on the border. And Leah is going to be with Yaakov forever in Maras Machpelah. Leah starts downtrodden and emerges as eternal. Rachel starts with such potential and is on some level a very tragic figure in Tanakh. And if you project into the future even, the offspring of these two mothers, so the institutions of Klal Yisrael, the most enduring institutions, the most chashuv institutions, they come from Leah. We know, for example, the first king of Israel, Shaul HaMelech, which Shevet did he come from? Binyamin, that's Rachel. But how long did that Malchus last? It doesn't last very long. David, who came from Yehuda, that's forever. Yosef HaTzadik, very beautiful. And he had royalty. He had capacity for royalty. But the institution of Malchus and Klal Yisrael, at the end of the day, comes from Yehuda, comes from Leah. And you take a look at the Kahuna and Leviah is all Leah. And we're going to have in the future two Mashiachs. It's going to be a Mashiach Ben Yosef, who's going to be the beginning, who's going to get us started, who's going to build the infrastructure. But that's not the eternal Mashiach. The eternal Mashiach is Mashiach Ben David. And it's a long story. But Leah's midah, if you will, is she might start off with a tough background, with a tough lot, with things going against her. But through the power of Leah, she perseveres, she struggles, and she endures. And she achieves, and the institutions of Klal Yisrael, she's Berg Maas Machpelah, Kohen, Levi, David HaMelech Mashiach, is all Leah. And Rachel starts with such promise. And, of course, not her fault. But the potential that is in Leah, for some reason, doesn't get realized. It's so striking that who is the crier of these two mothers of Klal Yisrael? We're told, Einei Leah Rakos, her eyes are soft because of all the tears that she sheds thinking her lot with Esav. But the real crier of Klal Yisrael, and I say it in a very complimentary way, in a good way, is Rachel Imenu. Because Rachel, who's buried by Beis Lechem, She's the one, Rachel Mevake Abaneha. She's the eternal crier for Jews in Galus, for Jews who have not reached their fulfillment. That's Rachel, who have not reached their potential. For whatever reason, not their fault. That's Rachel Imenu, and she, her crying is a crying for 2,000 years of Galus. And that's the legacy of Rachel. So as we go ahead and embark on our individual and collective missions, first to understand that the goal of everything is ma'arichin be'echad. Broaden. Don't live double lives. Don't be compartmentalized. Don't be a true yid. Is a yid in the business world, in college, on the basketball court. It's all the same. These are just rooms in the same house, under the same roof. And the axis always revolves around our relationship with Hashem. And at the same time, realize that what's so crucial is not how you start, but it's how you finish. And the enduring, the perseverance, the struggle has the capacity to produce the long-term benefits, the long-term goals, the long-term gifts that we see from Leah. I wish everyone a tremendous Shabbos Kodesh, and we should be successful in realizing our missions. Yeah.